Certainly.
Thank you. The issue in this case, I assume it is very simple, and that simply is that Kenneth Mitchell, the victim in the case, did not have a legal right to the truck that was taken by Mr. Doss. Normal elements of grand larceny we have to concede here. Mr. Doss came and took the truck, and the truck was in Mr. Mitchell's physical possession at that time. But we submit that he did not have a legal possessory right to the truck. The reason he did not have that legal possessory right is that when the title was signed over to him, the truck was titled in the name of Leslie Biggs. Now, Leslie Biggs, the record is clear, is the defendant, Brent Doss's girlfriend, and Leslie Biggs is present at the transaction. She's 5 feet away. The actual signing of the title takes place in the cab of the truck where William Doss, the defendant appellant in this case, his father, signs Leslie Biggs' name to the title, and the title is then handed over. Those facts are not in dispute. The issue appellant submits is whether or not William Doss had authority from Leslie Biggs to sign her name to the title. And we would submit that the record is devoid of any indication where a court could reasonably infer that any authority was given. In fact, the trial court says there's nothing explicit. Leslie Biggs was not present and did not testify.
Counsel, why wouldn't he have implied authority, which would essentially revolve around whether the person whose item it is or who actually has the authority sort of acquiesces the conduct of the other person, in this case, Mr. Doss's father, William Doss.
Certainly. I think I would submit first that mere presence is not acquiescence. And I think the trial court tried to address that in its reason for decision in saying that there was no protest from Ms. Biggs. There was no objection raised by her. But I would submit that implied authority is more than mere presence to a transaction. You have to have some affirmative action in order to cloak an agent in implied authority. Now, the closest that comes, and this is the harshest fact for my position, so I think I need to address it head on.
Your client drove the truck, and he had a conversation with Mr. Mitchell saying he wanted the vehicle. So,
yes, sir, you're absolutely right. My client, that is Mr. Doss, mm-hmm. absolutely drove the truck, absolutely said, yes, I want the vehicle. But I would submit the dispositive question was not Mr. Doss's intent. He clearly wanted the trade and wanted the vehicle, but it wasn't his to trade away. It was Leslie Biggs' vehicle to trade away. So the question I submit is whether Leslie Biggs gave William Doss, not my client, my client's father, the authority to give away her truck. I think it's a much clearer case, and I don't know that I even get before your honors if my client, Brent Doss, my client didn't do that. His father did.
But counsel, the titles are exchanged.
They are.
And then there's a swap of vehicles. So
yes.
Why couldn't the court come from those facts that there is, in fact, implied authority? That it was more than just acquiescence. There was tacit approval because there's the exchange of the titles and then there's...
Exchange of the cars.
Yes. Thank you very much, Judge Alston. This is what would be called an assist. He helped me on that.
I would submit because there was no assist by Ms. Biggs, to use your analogy. I mean, Ms. Biggs didn't do or say anything, I submit, other than get in the car and leave. And I don't think, and that's not enough for acquiescence, I submit, for implied authority. Now, the closest I think the Commonwealth can get in the record, and I should address this head on, is on page 15 of the joint appendix, where Mr. Mitchum says, do you all want to trade? And they agreed, yes, we want to trade. I made an objection to clarify who actually said that. And going into page 16, the question was by both being who would be helpful to know names. And the answer was, I mean him, and I don't mean I know their name, but him and the girl. On the next page, in 17, I object again to another statement, and the court infers, or the court states on page 20 of the joint appendix, that I infer essentially that the statement was made by the defendant. And I think that that's buttressed by the fact that in Judge Greer's reason for decision, he does not list any statement supposedly made by Ms. Biggs as his sign of acquiescence. I mean, he ruled that Ms. Biggs' presence and lack of protest was what cloaked William Doss in implied authority. think that the facts taken together, we don't dispute that those facts happened, and I understand that the standard of review, you've got to construe them in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth at this stage.
Which is critical. I'm glad that you said that, because the trial judge was very clear in the analysis of the evidence. He said that he believed that your client's position was absurd, which is a pretty strong word to use in situations like that. So essentially, the trial judge was saying, I'm not buying into anything that you're saying, and I think it was a letter discussion saying, look, probably what happened is your client got the raw deal of an as-is deal.
Your Honor's correct, and while I wish the standard was different, I won't tilt at windmills. You have to look at this in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and that's why I'm not arguing my client's testimony at all, because it was entirely disregarded by the trial court, and you would have to find that that disregarding of my client's testimony was plain error, and I don't submit that you have plain error here in that respect of the trial court's decision. So what that leaves, I submit, is the facts of what Ms. Biggs did or didn't do is what controls. Certainly, my client disagrees with the trial court's analysis because he so testified in the trial.
But getting back to Judge Malvo's question about implied authority, and implied authority has been defined as from the words used, from customs, and from the relations of the parties. That's the term that's been used, I believe it's from the Watson case. And so if we take that analytical framework, where do we get from the issue of whether or not relation of the parties? It appears that there's a relationship between Ms. Biggs and Mr. Doss. Mr. Doss is doing most of the conversing with the victim in the case. Mr. Doss is the person who drives the vehicle away. Mr. Doss is the person who seems to be in control of the negotiation, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yes, Mr. Brent Doss.
Mr. Brent Doss. And so, therefore, the trial judge says that this was a situation where your client was just trying to take advantage of a situation that he created and again, wanted to change the nature of the deal.
Your Honor's point and Judge Greer's point is predicated, I submit, on my client having the authority to negotiate the deal in the first place, because he's really negotiating on behalf of Ms. Biggs. And the evidence in the record, I submit, is that Ms. Biggs is Mr. Doss's girlfriend, but there's a total lack of action on Ms. Biggs's part that I believe makes an inference of implied authority reasonable. She doesn't do anything, or I submit, say anything that comes into evidence to give the court the reasonableness, the reasonable predicate, I would submit, to make that inference. Court can certainly infer from the circumstances of the case, but case law is clear that inference must be reasonable. And I don't think that simply being present 5 feet away is a reasonable inference.
Let me give you another example to see how you deal with this. And the situation is not too distinct from the way things are in my family. My wife has a car, and it's in her name. I forgot why it's in her name, but it is in her name. And so if we were in a position of wanting to trade the car away to buy another car, my wife is not involved in the negotiations of any transactions in our family. It's just the way our dynamic is. She's a good woman. She's a lot smarter than I am. But if we're going to deal with trading a car, even though the car is in her name, I'm going to be the one doing most of the talking. That's just the way things are in our family. And I would think that a reasonable salesperson would be able to rely on the fact that Austin showed up with his wife, car's in his name, her name, he's doing most of the talking, he's probably in a position to negotiate this deal for me, so I'm going to talk to him. What would be wrong with a person being under the reasonable apprehension that the person who's actually doing all the talking, which apparently is what's going on here, has implied authority to engage in the transaction?
Well, I would have two responses, and the first would be, I think if your wife was present in your scenario, I would think that any reasonable salesman would have your wife actually sign the title because it is titled in her name. I mean, that would be the cleanest way to handle it.
But not necessarily the only way it could be handled.
Certainly not the only way, but the added wrinkle I submit on the facts of this case is that a third person actually signed the title over. So in your salesman, to make it situation, hypothetical, to make it analogous to this case, it would be your father who's present actually is the one that signs your wife's name to the title. And I think that adds a wrinkle to this that makes it not a reasonable inference. And that's why I said at the beginning of my argument, I think if my client, Mr. Brent Doss is the one that signs over the title, I have a much weaker case. But we don't have that here. We have William Doss signing on behalf of his son's girlfriend. And that's where, you know, I think that what's
it's not a secondary authority, it's actually tertiary authority.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, it's not, because the court would have to believe either that William Doss got authority from Leslie Biggs, and I don't think there's any evidence of that, or the court would have to believe that Leslie gave authority to Brent Doss, who then gave authority to William Doss.
But implied authority doesn't necessarily require that she say to him, he has my authority, correct?
Correct. It would be either express or apparent at that point.
Right, and what we have here could be a situation where if she's standing there, the title is signed and handed over. Would you concede that there could be, that there are facts that would support the implied authority in reference to that? That doesn't have to come from your client, from the appellant.
I would concede that there are facts that are not present here that could have been present and proven that are nonverbal that would cloak or give that implied authority. For example, if Miss Biggs produced the title, you know, took it out of her purse and handed it to William Doss, and then William Doss goes and signs her name, I think that action would be an example of, you know, I never said he has the authority to do this, but certainly by my action of taking the title out of my purse and handing it to him, the court could reasonably infer that implied authority exists. Or if, for example, the evidence showed that Miss Leslie Biggs peered over William Doss's shoulder and sat there and watched him sign the title as opposed to standing, you know, 5 feet away. I think that those facts are not explicit, certainly, but could lead to an implied authority. And I see I'm at the 3-minute mark. If the court has any questions, I'm happy to answer, and I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth in this appeal. The Commonwealth is asking that you affirm the defendant's larceny conviction because the Commonwealth proved that the victim in this case was the owner of the truck and had property interest in the truck that the defendant deprived him of. When you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, it is clear that the defendant's father signed the title over to the victim, and that he did it with the authority of Leslie Biggs, whose name was on the title and who owned the truck. Biggs was present for this entire transaction. The record actually shows that she test drove the Mustang with the defendant. She fully participated in this transaction, except for actually signing this title. The record also supports, and the trial court wholly credited the victim in this case, calling his testimony completely credible, that he said she test drove the car with the defendant. They all agreed to trade the vehicles. And in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, it is clear that William Doss had authority from Leslie Biggs.
And you would agree that the best authority that you could come up with in this case would be implied authority. There's no express authority that you can point to. So we have to get to implied authority. And what your opponent colleague is suggesting is that we have to work our way through several baffles to get to that implied authority. The first baffle that we have to get through is that the Ms. Biggs gave authority to her boyfriend, who then gave authority to her father. When we're dealing with implied authority, how are we able to work our way through all those baffles?
I do not believe that the court has to say that she gave authority to her boyfriend and then to his father. I think she gave it directly to his father. I think the record supports that the three of them went to this transaction, and yes, the defendant in this case, the record shows he was the original one who reached out in this ad and reached out to the victim suggesting that they trade vehicles. But then all three of them went to the transaction and were involved in the transaction.
What facts, specific facts, would you point to suggest that there had been this implied authority granted from Ms. Biggs to the appellant defendant in this case?
I would say by both her verbal and nonverbal actions that she went to this transaction with them. She test drove the Mustang with the defendant. She was present a mere 5 feet away while they discussed it
So your argument is essentially that William Doss facilitated the transaction. Brent Doss did what he could do to undermine the transaction. Would that be your argument, if I'm misstating it?
I don't think that's my argument. I think they all were actors in the transaction. Okay. I think Brent Doss, and I would have to, obviously, some of the inferences I would have to be taking, and I think the trial court could have taken, are that they were testing the Mustang out for Leslie Biggs, and that's why him, Brent, the defendant in this case, and Leslie are the two that test drove it. And yes, that William Doss was just helping and facilitating in that he was the one who signed it. I think that that's a fair reading of the record. I think it's a complete reasonable reading of the record. I think what the trial court did, the trial court made a lot of very specific factual findings when it gave its opinion in weighing the testimony. And
I agree with you that the trial court made some very specific determinations and basically came to the conclusion that the case smells from Mr. Brent Doss's standpoint. But I think what's being suggested is that while the case smells, is there any legal culpability associated with Brent Doss's conduct?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor, because after the title was signed and they all took the Mustang, the next day Brent Doss goes and steals the defendant's truck, which has been signed over to him by Leslie Biggs and William Doss.
Okay. So your focus isn't so much on the transaction itself, it's more focused on what Brent Doss did after the transaction.
Well, that's, Your Honor, that's the taking after the transaction, and that's his intent, which below the defendant did challenge whether or not the Commonwealth had proven his larcenous intent to steal the truck, whether based on what exactly he knew about the transaction. But that's not before you on appeal. All that's before this court on appeal is whether or not Meacham, the victim, actually had a property interest in the truck, or whether it was Leslie Biggs the whole time, and therefore, per the indictment, the defendant did not commit grand larceny against the victim. And based on the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth did prove that the defendant stole the truck from the named victim in this case. The record supports the inferences that Biggs assented both verbally and non-verbally to the transaction and William Doss signing the title. And based on all the evidence, the trial court was not plainly wrong to find that Biggs had implicitly authorized him to sign. And if there are no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell.
May it please the court, Ms. Campbell brought up the test drive as one of the facts that could lead the court to conclude that Ms. Biggs assented to the transaction, but I think we need to have the fact of that test drive clear. On page 16 of the joint appendix, the Commonwealth was clear when he says, when they tried the car out, who drove off in it? And Mr. Mitchum said yes, and the Commonwealth clarified you're referring to the defendant, and the answer was yes. And we get more clarity, I submit, on page 55 of the joint appendix, my question to my client was who test drove the car, and my client testified that it was me and my father, that he was driving, and that Miss Biggs, on page 56, he says we had Leslie follow us. So I think if you look at those facts, this is kind of good to go back, Judge Alston, to your hypothetical where you're going with your wife to sell the car that's in her name. Even in this case, the test drive of the actual vehicle that is the subject of the larceny taking was test driven not by Miss Biggs, the owner, and she wasn't even a passenger in the test drive. She was following them while Brent Doss and William Doss did the test drive. So I think that it may again be a different case, you know, if there's an affirmative action taken by Miss Biggs that could let the court conclude that she gave an implied authority here, as Judge Malveaux pointed out in my prior argument. But I would submit to the court that even when you look at the facts and the light was favorable to the Commonwealth, which I concede you must do, you don't have any one or more facts that you can point to that would allow either the trial court or Your Honor's on appeal to conclude that that Ms. Biggs gave that implied authority to William Doss or to Brent Doss, who then gave it to William Doss. Counsel is correct that I did not bring up the intent portion on appeal. That's not before you. But I would submit that the case rises and falls as to whether or not Mr. Mitchum had a legal interest that could have property taken from him, as the indictment was specific and charged the larceny as property belonging to Kenneth Mitchum. So if there are no other questions, I'll be happy to submit.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel.